Swaraj would only come, he believed, when India and individuals found a way to free themselves from the seduction of modern life. That's The Essay, every night this coming week at 11, except Wednesday. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone midday. Time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And today there's another chance to hear a programme first broadcast in the autumn of 2008.
Nick Clegg is leader of the Liberal Democrats, and he's also the MP for Sheffield Hallam. Your early days in politics was in Europe, wasn't it?
Yes, I was for 5 years a member of the European Parliament for the East Midlands constituency, which is a sort of neighbouring constituency to my present Westminster constituency. But before then also, I'd spent some time not in politics, but working. I managed European development aid projects in the former Soviet Union and various other things.
But the one good thing that you got out of the European Union, well, one of the good things was your wife.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I went for 9 months to a sort of postgraduate college called the Collège d'Europe, which was an amazing sort of melting pot of different sort of nationalities, obviously, as the name implies. In effect, a sort of training ground for Eurocrats, but it also acted in its spare time as a fantastic matchmaking facility for girls and boys from across the European Union. And yes, I saw my wife-to-be on the first day that I was in. I was completely smitten. Couldn't speak to her in English for the first few weeks because her English was incomprehensible. So our courtship was conducted in French.
Now, the Liberal Democrats have, I imagine to a lot of people listening to a programme like this at this particular time, a lot of people must be thinking this would be quite a good moment to forge ahead when there's lots of sort of jostling, isn't there, in the other parties at the moment of one sort or another. And you must have this huge challenge, which is to make that final leap where people will actually say, OK, go with us, you know, if you'll say that, and that they will do so. Is that sort of...
Yeah, that's a fair assessment, I think. There's a glass ceiling which we need to break through. It's quite a thick glass ceiling because, of course, without boring everybody about the iniquities of the political system, it's quite difficult to break into this old established pattern of swinging between one party and the other. But it's happening bit by bit. I think sometimes people forget quite how much the political map of Britain has changed. You know, my party now runs almost all the large cities outside London. It's quite extraordinary. Metropolitan Britain has become Liberal Democrat Britain in many important respects. Liverpool, Sheffield, Newcastle, Hull, Grimsby, the list goes on. And, you know, we've been lucky enough to share power in Scotland and Wales recently. We hold a balance of power in the House of Lords, in the European Parliament. We had more votes in the last general election than any other Liberal Party in Europe. So it's going in the right direction.
But what do you think it would take, in fact, to make that final push which would move you onto a different plane?
Oh, gosh, it's very difficult to predict. One always, if one makes predictions in politics, they're almost always confounded. My sense is that the old established patterns of politics no longer exist. If you know, in the old days, or even a few years ago, if you came from a certain part of the country or did a particular trade or lived on a particular street, you voted a particular way, and that was handed down from grandparents to parents to children. That's now stopped. The old class-based affiliation of politics has stopped. And in its place has come something much more volatile, much more fickle, and much more difficult to predict. And I think the biggest danger is that if we don't change politics to suit that more plural, diverse environment, the whole thing might wither on the vine. I mean, and the writing's already on the wall. 2001 general election was the first time that more people didn't vote than voted for the governing party, and it happened again in 2005. So lots of people are voting with their feet by not voting at all. And I guess what I hope to do, and I've only just started, I've only been in the job for the last 6 or 7 months, it's just to enthuse more and more people just to come back into politics and give new voices a chance, including, of course, the Liberal Democrats.
Well, I'm sure we'll touch on some of this later. Let's have some music. And I think the first piece we're going to hear, you probably heard, thanks to your father.
Yes, that's right. My dad was a big, well, obviously he still is a great influence in my life and a very, very positive one. But he filled our house, and I come from quite a big family, four boys and girls and lots of cousins and uncles, quite a large, rowdy family. But it was always filled with music, and he did that. He would put on his favourite piece of music, put it on full volume, and you couldn't help but listen.
And what does it mean to you, just as a piece of music, do you think? Oh, the artist here, too, is important.
Oh, of course. Well, Brendel is, I mean, I'm no expert, but it just seems to me, I mean, I've very casually compared his recordings of the Schubert impromptus with others. It just seems to me to take on a completely different quality. It's such delicate music. It's such a sort of fine.
You see,
fabric.
Actually, although you downplay your opinion, I'm very fascinated by this, because half the point of this programme, it's private passion. So nobody's expecting you to be a musicologist. So the reason why you might find this playing interesting is, to me, quite fascinating, because, as you say, you don't bring an expert, but it's just what it says to you.
This piece and the way it's played, it's the delicacy of it, where you literally feel the weight of every note. You feel that is delivered with such precision, such extraordinary precision, because nothing obscures anything else in this piece and so many of the other impromptus. And that's why the craft, I guess, of Brendel is so much more obvious than it might be in other pieces of music. It's only one instrument, it's alone, it's bare, it's sparse.
And of course the beauty of the music demands this kind of playing.
Yes, absolutely. And I was sort of looking at the music I've selected this afternoon. I mean, this has a strong melancholy to it as well, which I suddenly slightly realised looking at it. It perhaps unites
but
a lot of
that is not uncommon.
Is that not uncommon?
No.
No, I was asking myself the other day, I mean, I'm probably someone who will more readily play music to be moved to tears than be moved to dance. And again, I'm sure that is uncommon, but it certainly applies to this beautiful, beautiful piece of music.
Thank you.
One of the advantages of choosing that piece, Nick Clegg, is that you get such a sort of variety of emotions, don't you?
Full range, don't you? Full range. Actually, just listening to it again, the tempo of it changes so dramatically, very dramatically. The range with which he plays it is amazing every time I listen to it.
Of course, music is one of those things that where you can change mood almost in an instant. You don't have to set up a new scene or change the scenery or cut one. You can.
I'm not sure if science will ever be able to capture exactly what happens to a human being when I think music and possibly poetry gets closest to it, but music seems to be in a class of its own. It seems to me of the arts, and be able to switch and elicit and provoke emotions like no other.
And it is interesting because people do on this programme on the whole, and we have done hundreds now. They do have a preponderance of music that moves them, as you were saying, more to tears than to joy, which is surprising.
Yeah. But
I think it's something to do with the human condition, that, you know, that we're all yearning for something. We're all looking for something in a way. We all know what you're looking for, but...
There are other things in life. Even I think that. I do keep it in perspective, you know.
But seriously, that in a way that we want to be deeply moved.
Yes, I do think it slightly depends from person to person. I mentioned my father earlier. I only think of him because he's half Russian and quite sort of Slavic by temperament. And I saw from my Russian relatives that they really have a wonderful capacity of just sort of relishing, if you like, the melancholy, the waves of emotion. And others kind of don't embrace it quite so much. I think there are quite big differences between people and cultures about how much people permit themselves to get moved by music.
Well, we heard the impromptu in E-flat minor by Schubert, played by Alfred Brendel. Mozart next, Nick.
Yes, I'm rifling through my memory to remember why I chosen them. There was no great moment, there was no sort of blinding light, if you like, which explains why I chose this piece. I think the way it's sung by Kiri Tikhanov, at least in this recording, I haven't compared to any others, the way the sort of voice, in particular at the beginning, sort of floats in, it almost imperceptibly creeps up on you. And that's a very, very, very powerful beginning. And of course, it's just an amazingly tender piece of music. Well, I'm not religious, but I almost could be. Well, that's listening
the,
to that.
That's the extraordinary thing about music, isn't it? Maybe he was talking about tenderness, but the other word you might use is a kind of fragility of the human condition.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why we find music that moves us very deeply, reminds us of our own kind of impermanence.
Absolutely. I mean, particularly these days, I think, I say this as a politician with some feeling, I mean, it's as if people have to sort of clip armour on every morning to sort of battle through the day. And, of course, the music reminds you in an instant the other dimensions, which are often, suppressed during the day, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, do you get time to
listen to music?
I mean, when you're busy, especially as the leader of a party, I mean, it must be very hard to get time for doing things like listening to music or playing tennis or skiing.
To be honest, no, time gets terrifically compressed. If I'm frank, it's the double whammy of modern political life, which is very overstretched, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I've got young children. So, I try and spend every drop of time that I can when I'm not busy with them. And children, of course, are as intolerant of sitting down listening to some beautiful music as politics is.
And, of course, the other thing is that if you're the leader of a group, a party like you are, then you are quite rightly turned to for an opinion on everything, so that it's not just the other two. So that means it's endless from that point of view, I suppose.
Yes, it is. And also, I think what is not seen by the public, quite rightly, but is actually a very time-consuming business in politics, is that people forget that political parties are quite complex organisations, made up of thousands of people doing different things up and down the country, often doing so voluntarily, but in an increasingly sort of professional political environment where you're under a great deal of scrutiny. So there's a whole dimension of politics which is, if you like, behind the scenes, but still very, very important, which is making sure that your organisation works effectively.
Yeah, because, I mean, you might have, for example, like a very good person like Vince Cable in economics, who's made quite an impression, clearly. But nevertheless, you've got to be singing from the same...
Singing from the hymn sheet. You've always got campaigns up and down the country. I think the biggest trick in politics, I suspect, well, I think, is so much of it is the immediate, is the reactive, is one scandal, one story, that the news is so hyperbolic these days. Every day there's some breathless piece of news which dominates the news until the next issue displaces it. And to try and discern what is important and what is long-term in that kind of scrum of competing immediate issues is the real trick, I think.
Well, what's important now is the first record you really earned. And, but we heard before that the Mozart Laudate Dominum from the Solemn Vespers of Mozart, Kirkel 339, beautifully sung by Kyrie Takanawa, with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Barry Rose. Polish orchestra to play Polish music now.
Yes, I chose this because I think this is the first classical record, you know, the old LP-style record that I ever owned. I still remember distinctly. I've lost it, sadly, but I remember the cover. It was a rather grainy, black and white, moody picture of Ashkenazi close up. This must have been when I was 11, 12, 13. I can't put my finger on it. But I distinctly remember listening to this over and over and over again.
It's interesting because he's better known in some ways, Chopin, for the solo piano music. But
absolutely.
Here Vladimir Ashkenazi.
Well, we'll get
joined,
to that later. But yes.
Yeah, by the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra, and it's music from the second piano concerto.
Thank you.
That was the second movement, the Larghetto of the Chopin Piano Concerto No. 2 in F minor, with Vladimir Ashkenazy playing the piano and the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Dzislaw Gorzynski. We were just talking, Nick Clegg, about how quite often the people that one meets in life who one is most impressed with are the unsung heroes.
Yes, that's certainly my experience as someone who's lucky enough for my job, if you like. I don't quite regard it as a job, I regard it as a vocation. But I spend a lot of my time travelling around the country, and I just think there are people who do miracles every day of the week, every week of the year, with the sick, with the elderly, with children, who in a sense do more extraordinary things than people who are publicly known for their extraordinary things. Just last week I was visiting a project for a homeless family in the East End of London, in Newham, and a couple of young women who've been working with the family there completely thanklessly and selflessly, but probably do more for that family than any number of government directives.
The reason why I bring that up, Nick Clegg, is because very often somebody at school, a teacher, can introduce you to something which opens the door to a whole new world. And I think that happened to you.
It did. I had a wonderful German teacher at school. I was incredibly lucky, a chap called Richard Stokes, who those who know a lot about Schubert Lieder will know well, because he's written copious essays and books about it. He's a renowned expert on it. And but I only knew him as my German teacher. I did German A-level. And he managed to do something, which is very rare, I think, in teaching, is that he taught us brilliantly. I think he consistently produced classes which met every target that you ever want to meet in terms of the grades that were achieved. But in the process, really instilled a love of German, a love of German literature, and particularly a love of the Schubert Lieder. I'm sure that wasn't prescribed by the curriculum. I'm sure it perhaps wasn't even allowed by the curriculum these days. But it really showed that if you have a creative teacher... I think he knew Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. And I know he took us to see Fischer-Dieskau sing the Lieder in London once. And also we went on a school exchange to a school in Munich and took us to see him there as well. And that's quite, I mean, you know, to instill that kind of love for this kind of music, and it's quite complex music, quite a lot of the German's quite difficult to follow in a bunch of spotty youths, is quite an achievement.
So which Schubert song would you like to...
Well, I've chosen Elkönig, which of course is one of the most famous of all, and this great sort of rhythm of the horse through the night, yeah. And the growing panic, really, and I almost feel it around my neck, this kind of terrible panic as you feel the child being snatched away from his father.
Mein Vater, und hörest du? ruhig, mein Kind, in dürren Blättern säuselt der Wind. Willst feiner Grabe du mit mir gehen? Meine Töchter sollen dich warten schön. Meine Töchter führen den nächtlichen Rhein. Sie wiegen und tanzen und singen dich ein. Sie wiegen und tanzen und singen dich ein. Mein Vater, und siehst du nicht dort, Herr Königstöchter am düstern Ort? Mein Sohn, ich sehe es genau, es scheinen die alten Weiden so grau.
Wonderful characterization.
Unbelievable.
I suppose that Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Gerald Moore are to Schubert Lieder what Alfred Brendel is to the Schubert piano literature.
That's certainly what I was, yes, it was firmly impressed upon me by my teacher at school, absolutely.
Erlkönig by Schubert. Your wife plays the piano. I wonder whether you feel that, I often think in this country we produce some great artists, but that in the general populace there's a certain philistinism, and that's not always what one encounters in other European countries, where there seems to be a greater hunger for art.
Well, my wife is Spanish, and yes, what is striking, I always think, it's not just in the arts, by the way, in politics too. I think the greatest insult you can deliver someone in British politics is too clever by half.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I think it's a very healthy thing that we want to bring everybody, you know, down to earth, keep people's feet on the ground, don't let anyone, you know, get too big for their boots. That's a good thing. But I also think sometimes maybe we could do a little bit more to celebrate people, you know, striving to do great things in academia. And I mean, the French have a role for philosophers. They can sometimes be, frankly, insufferably pompous and self-regarding, but it's amazing. They have this role for philosophers who talk about life and the universe on the national stage. Certainly in Spain, you see the way they celebrate public art, architecture in every small town and village. They want great art on display for everybody, and there's no derision heaped on it. I think that's not wholly a bad thing.
Do you think it's partially the court system that pertained in Europe, which meant that people valued and actually employed artists and artisans, whereas in this country we didn't really have it to that extent?
Yeah, it might be a north-south thing. I mean, if that is true, then you tend to see that slightly more sort of flattening, down-to-earth view take hold in Northern Europe, which, of course, in many ways you do. But, of course, having said all of that, I think one of the things that I think is good is that we don't have, on the whole, this tradition of seeing public authorities and public power and the state, whether it's regional, local, national, try to sort of occupy and appropriate culture. I think in this country it creates problems because often the state doesn't fund the arts as much as many people would like. But we have a much more raucous, I think, approach to just letting a thousand flowers bloom, and that has to be a good thing for the creative process.
Yes, and as I said, I think we do actually
absolutely
create some quite very fine artists.
Staggering, yes.
But the piece we're going to hear, I think, is a piece that your wife plays, which is why we've got it.
Yes. No, this is for pure, unadulterated, unapologetic, romantic reasons. My wife is a good pianist, and when we first met, I used to lovingly listen to her play this beat, and she still plays, and I still listen enraptured, but this was just a piece that I associate when we first met, whatever it is, over 15 years ago now.
Claudio Arrau was playing the waltz in A minor by Chopin. Do you think she'd approve of that particular performance? Perhaps she chose it.
I think she would approve. It's an absolute little gem, isn't it? It really is. Yeah.
We were talking about how influences feed into your life. You talked about Richard Stokes, and you talked there about your wife, and earlier talked about your father. And it is quite salutary, isn't it, that if people are exposed to things with which they're enthused, that it can transform their lives. And that perhaps is one of the great divides socially that we need to address, that actually if we could expose children, you know, more often. We've seen it in various series on television like the Prokofiev Ballet and the Choir, where when people are given the chance to be disciplined and to actually achieve something and to have, I think the word that I remember hearing some children saying they'd never had until then was aspiration.
Yes, and in pride in themselves. I mean, my own view, having spent a lot of time meeting young kids who've got into trouble, both in Sheffield and around the country, is that I think the thing that unites them all is a lack of self-confidence, a lack of self-worth. I mean, just down the road from where we're sitting here now in London, about a year or two back, I went to a drugs court for young, they're almost all boys who got into trouble with drugs, and the judge there did something quite different. He wouldn't just sentence them and send them away and then never see them again. He would develop a relationship with them, and he'd say, I want you to do this, that and the other, and come back in a few months' time and tell me how you've got on. And I spoke to some of these young kids, and it was a complete transformation for them, because they said no one until then had taken any interest in them, had not congratulated them. I mean, this judge, an eccentric, unusual chap, would sort of hug them if they'd done well. He would show them affection, support. And I think that giving youngsters who feel that they've got nothing to lose a sense that they've got a lot to gain in life is absolutely vital. And it can be done in so many different ways.
Of course, you and I were privileged in that we had fathers who introduced us to things that shed that kind of light.
Yep. Yes, well, the next piece, actually, that I've selected is a classic example. My dad, this was actually quite recently, a few years ago, he suddenly developed a passion for Richard Strauss, and particularly the famous four last songs. And, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, and kept playing it over and over again and said, got to listen to this, the famous Schwarzkopf recordings. And yes, I'm incredibly lucky that I have parents who wanted to share those kind of things with an enthusiasm that hasn't dimmed from one year to the next.
And when you listen to this music, what does it sort of say to you, or when you did hear it and you began to love it?
These songs, the sense of, well, at least that's the way I felt it, the sense of sort of decline, in some cases decay.
Valediction.
Valediction, exactly, that's the right word. Very, very powerful, very powerful. Bringing out music from a sort of sense of end and then renewal, but certainly this extraordinary sense of things slowing down to a halt.
Very interesting that Strauss should have begun his sort of operatic career with white-hot operas like Elektra and Salome, and then ended with these pieces which, as we were just saying, are sort of valedictory and looking back at some bygone age. Yes. One thinks of the Metamorphosen or even the end of Rosenkavalier, and one thinks particularly of these four last songs.
Yeah, it's a bit like Shakespeare writing The Tempest. I mean, it seems to sort of gather together all different threads of life and experience and bringing them all together, but doing so with I've used this word before, maybe I'm overusing it, with a sort of a tenderness and a delicacy which is very memorable.
Thank you.
and the spirit unguarded longs to soar on free wings, so that in the magic circle of night it may live deeply and a thousandfold. Hesse's words, set to music by Richard Strauss in Beim Schlafengehen, number 3 from The Four Last Songs, with Elizabeth Schwarzkopf and the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by George Sall. It was the wonderful use of the instruments as lyric voices that we noticed there, wasn't it, when we were listening? The use of the violin solo and that wonderful horn entry just towards the end.
Absolutely, and very sort of unobtrusively, I mean, very extremely compatible in a bit unusual way. I also love the German, Beim Schlafengehen. You can't really translate it. It's like so many things in German. You have these composite words, by going to sleep. I think it's a wonderful way of describing the mood.
I'm afraid it's time for us now to, as it were, go to sleep, Nick Clegg. Thank you very much for introducing us to the music that means so much to you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it enormously.
Nick Clegg was talking to Michael Barclay, and that programme was recorded and first broadcast in the autumn of 2008. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the record producer William Orbit. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, no sleeping for you, I hope, because we've got a full afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Let's tell you about something upcoming.
The unmistakable voice of Mark Padmore. He joins us for the first Proms chamber music recital of the season, celebrating Schumann's bicentenary with the intimate and poignant Dichterliebe, a lively piano miniature played by Imogen Cooper, and four Schubert songs, including Die Sterne. Join me, Catherine Bott, for this year's first chamber prom with Mark Padmore and Imogen Cooper. That's the lunchtime concert tomorrow at 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
News coming up in just a minute's time. That's time enough for me to tell you about next weekend, in which the Doctor is back. 2 years ago, he appeared at the Proms via a video link, and this year he's there in person. Doctor Who. Matt Smith will be coming to the Royal Albert Hall with his assistant, Amy Pond, played by Karen Gillan, for an action-packed evening alongside the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and the London Philharmonic Choir. Monsters from the current run of the massively successful BBC television series threaten to disrupt the proceedings, and only the Doctor, ably assisted by the conductors Ben Foster and Grant Llewellyn, can save the day. There'll be some classical favourites with a suitably celestial theme, including Mars from Holst's Planet Suite and John Adams's thrilling Short Ride in a Fast Machine. I'm not sure what that's to do with celestial things, but there we are. The score for each television programme is written by Murray Gold and recorded by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Petro Trelawney will have the unenviable task of keeping everything in order for Radio 3, though perhaps sadly without the help of a sonic screwdriver. So that's the prom next Saturday night, starting at 7:30. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, and on digital radio, 1 o'clock the time, and that means the news from Vaughan Savage.
At least 43 people have been killed in a suicide bombing near the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Another 40 were injured in the attack, which targeted Sawar militiamen queuing for their wages. Three other people died in a second suicide attack on a Sawar office near the Syrian border. The pro-government militia, recruited mainly from Sunni Arab tribesmen, is credited with turning the tide in the war against al-Qaeda in Iraq. A suicide bomb blast aimed at a convoy of foreign troops in the Afghan capital Kabul has killed at least three civilians. Security in the city had been stepped up 2 days before the city is due to host an international conference on Afghanistan's future. Up to 70 foreign ministers, including the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, are due to attend the gathering. The British government is planning to boost spending on aid projects in Afghanistan by 40% as part of the strategy for the handover of security control to Afghan forces. Some of the Britons holidaying abroad with the collapsed tour operator Gold Trail say they're facing demands for extra payments from hotels. The Civil Aviation Authority says it's making good progress in arranging flights home for 16,000 customers of the Surrey-based firm, which went into administration on Friday. Nelson Mandela is celebrating his 92nd birthday. The occasion is being marked worldwide for the first time as Nelson Mandela International Day. A 40-mile stretch of one of Europe's busiest motorways, the Autobahn between Dortmund and Duisburg, is closed today for a giant street festival. The route is lined with what the organisers claim is the world's longest table, showcasing hobbies, clubs and bands. Among participants from across Europe, as well as the US and Japan, is a brass combo called Tuba Libre. The weather: rain will give way to sunny spells in Scotland, especially in the east. Outbreaks of rain and drizzle will persist, though, in northern England, Wales and Northern Ireland. It'll be largely dry and bright across England this afternoon. The BBC News and Weather at 2:30 past one.
And now this weekend's second instalment of the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
Precious sighs, O beloved torment, do not rob me of your wounds, which render sweet both death and life. Collegium Vocale Köln, singing from the fifth book of madrigals by Carlo Gesualdo, an Italian composer who lived one of the most dramatic lives of the 16th century, a murderer, manic depressive, a musical mannerist who was torn between the forces of life and a pathological yearning for death. This year marks the 400th anniversary of the death of an equally turbulent artist, whose wealthy patron even described as a man with a very odd brain. Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio used street children and prostitutes as models for the saints and sinners of his paintings, and he walked the streets of Rome with an armed servant boy to protect him from his low-life enemies. He lived and worked in chiaroscuro, dramatic contrasts of light and shade. In the 19th century, John Ruskin numbered Caravaggio among the worshippers of the depraved, and it wasn't until the 1950s that his work was rediscovered. There's still a danger that the sensational details of his short life can overshadow the marvels of his paintings. A few days ago, I had the pleasure of talking to an expert about Caravaggio's artistic legacy and some of the music that features in his paintings. The critic and presenter of TV's The Culture Show, Andrew Graham Dixon, has written an acclaimed biography, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane, which takes us through the painter's turbulent life in context with each work as he painted it. I asked Andrew Graham Dixon, what is it about Caravaggio that makes him so pertinent today, 400 years after his death?
In a sense, he's the perfect artist for an age obsessed by celebrity because he ticks all the boxes. You know, he's outrageous in his personal behaviour, and he kills a man, possibly while attempting to castrate him. He has sex with all kinds of people, the wrong kinds of people, prostitutes, young men. And he has this incredible life, and it's a tragic life, it's a very sad life. You know, he loses almost his entire male family when he's aged 5 to the plague in Milan, which I think explains a lot about him. I think he feels from the beginning, he feels as a sense of that he's been betrayed by God. He's been picked out, singled out for this terrible destiny. He seems to have been volatile from the start. He can't settle into any relationship. In his art, he's capable of this huge, extraordinary compassion and tenderness. The late Adoration in Messina is just, for me, one of the most moving paintings in the whole world. I mean, it's a painting about Mary and Jesus, but it's really a painting about refugees. It's a painting about this is the way that life is. You know, there will always be people in this predicament, abandoned by everybody. You know? And he feels, because he has suffered himself, he's got such a well of compassion and feeling. He's at his best as a person, as a human being in his art. He's extraordinary.